it for the third time in the space of 100 years, the United States would be safe on the other side of the world without realizing that in case of any ill-advised military move in Ukraine by Washington, today's hypersonic missiles could easily reduce North American cities to a rubble in a matter of moments. Biden said, "You have two options. Start a third world war, go to war with Russia, physically, or to make sure that the country that acts so contrary to international law ends up paying a price for having done it." He is talking trash. What he means by violation of international law could boomerang on the U.S., which is the prime violator of all international rules, and should be made to pay dearly for not just the sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran, but for the illegal presence of the CENTCOM terrorists in our region, as well as destabilization efforts in Venezuela and other Latin American states, in addition to the militarization of the South China Sea, where U.S. terrorist forces are numbered in several thousand in Japan and South Korea, besides fanning flames of sedition in the breakaway Chinese island of Taiwan. The Russian president makes sense when he defends the military operation in Ukraine by saying, "The purpose of this operation is to protect people who, for 8 years now, have been facing humiliation and genocide perpetrated by the Kiev regime. It is obvious that Moscow will not tolerate a Zionist clown like Volodymyr Zelensky to allow NATO to absorb Ukraine." According to reports from Kiev, Ukrainians have welcomed the Russian troops, and contrary to the propaganda of the Zionist-controlled Western media, there is no sign of the so-called resistance. Even with the weapons made available to the public for national defense and whatever it means, there are many people settling accounts with each other because of long-simmering personal vendetta, while the antisocial elements are using the Western-supplied armaments to attack and loot shops. Thus, it is crystal clear that NATO has badly blundered. A military organization that had no justification to exist following the end of Cold War in 1991 and the dismantling of its socialist rival, the Warsaw Pact, its dream of eastward expansion to the borders of Russia might finally lead to its own demise. Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. This week, we'll examine the Zionist-led attack on higher education in the UK and beyond. We'll focus on the attempt to remove voices critical of settler colonialism in British universities and on one key occasion that has done more than many to harass and intimidate universities, the Community Security Trust. As always, we'll be joined by expert guests to delve into the background of Israel's ethnic cleansing and explore what can be done about it. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report on the innocent-sounding Community Security Trust.
Why are academics from the United States to Britain being chased out of their jobs for standing with the Palestinians? From Stephen Salata to Cornel West, outspoken and high-profile university lecturers shunned from their positions are bitterly complaining about the influence of the Israel lobby. One of the most notable scalps claimed in Britain was our own resident expert, Professor David Miller of the University of Bristol, who was sacked in October 2021. But where did the bid to oust him come from? The years-long smear campaign against David Miller began with a UK charity named the Community Security Trust. But what is the CST and who exactly is behind it? The Community Security Trust was created in 1994, and its explicit aim is to campaign against anti-Semitism. Based in North London, critics have long charged that it deliberately blurs the distinction between anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel. The CST is run by the convicted fraudster and supporter of Netanyahu, Gerald Ronson. At the time of its founding, Ronson was a board member of the Israel lobby group, BICOM. So close to the Israeli government is Ronson that when serving jail time for fraud, he was phoned by serving Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Ronson and two other founding trustees of the CST were central to the United Jewish Israel Appeal, a UK fundraising vehicle described as one of Israel's national institutions. His charity of the Gerald and Gail Ronson Family Foundation has pledged over £4 million to the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds for settlers in East Jerusalem. A scanning of Ronson's memoirs reveals he prides himself on being good with his fists and holds Islamophobic views. Today, the CST works hard to give a more civilized impression. The Community Security Trust is lavished with funding by the British government. In 2012, Education Secretary Michael Gove allocated £2 million of public money to the CST, despite simultaneously sitting on the organization's advisory board. In fact, the CST receives millions in funding from the government every year. In April 2020, the Home Office gave the CST £40 million. The Home Secretary at the time was Priti Patel, who had famously had to resign in 2017 over unauthorized secret meetings with Israeli officials about directing public funds to the Zionist entity. While the CST claims it does not lobby for the Israeli regime, the evidence begs to differ, as the usurping entity fostered the idea of anti-Zionism as a new anti-Semitism. The CST has echoed that call consistently. According to Anthony Lerman, the director of the Institute of Jewish Policy Research, who previously worked very closely with the CST, Israel's external intelligence oversaw the regime's campaigns against anti-Semitism in the early 2000s. Lerman also asserts that CST staff have been trained by Israeli intelligence. One of the long-running criticisms of the organization has been that despite claims it protects the Jewish community, it actually targets some Jews as a threat. Left-wing Jews and those critical of Israel have been forcibly removed from meetings. One of the CST activities seems to be the creating of extensive files on critics of Israel. It was exposed that the CST submitted to the British Home Office a list of anti-Zionist Jews that it defined as extremists. The CST were also involved in working for a change in the law on universal jurisdiction, which protects war criminals of the Israeli regime from UK arrest. The organization was also on the executive committee of the Fair Play Campaign Group, a joint anti-BDS initiative of several Israel lobby groups. From 2003, the CST with other pro-Israel groups advised the Israeli regime's Coordination Forum for Monitoring Anti-Semitism. This produced a concerted effort to lobby for a definition of anti-Semitism that would assess them in censoring and then attempting to criminalize anti-Zionism and criticism of Israel more generally. This process ended with the adoption in 2016 of the International Holocaust Remembrance Association Working Definition of Anti-Semitism, a definition which prohibits identification of the racist nature of Zionism. This is the weapon of choice now being deployed against universities. The CST was behind the original complaint against Professor Miller at the University of Bristol. When that was rebuffed, the CST approached the Union of Jewish Students, with which they had a very close relationship, and the UJS put in a complaint as a result. The avalanche against David Miller consisted of parliamentarians and even a direct intervention serving housing minister with links to Israeli intelligence, Robert Jenrick. Despite being cleared by a Bristol University investigation of any form of anti-Semitism, David Miller was fired as the university administration crumbled under the pressure. As the victims of this witch hunt struggle to repair their lives and fight for their livelihoods, the question must be asked, why is an organization founded by a lobbyist for a foreign regime with staff trained by a foreign intelligence service being funded by the British taxpayer? And why is it attempting to dictate who can and who can't teach in British universities?
To discuss the Community Security Trust and the forces behind it, we're joined today by two guests. Chris Williamson is the former Labour MP for Derby North and a well-known campaigner for socialism and Palestinian rights. Chris was a Shadow Communities and Home Office Minister under Ed Miliband and Jeremy Corbyn. But since leaving Parliament in 2019, Chris has founded the Resist Movement for a People's Party and established the Left Legal Fighting Fund. He's also joined by our regular programme expert, David Miller, who is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Now, David, I'm going to start off with you because this is obviously quite personal for you. The CST were, of course, involved, as we've heard from Bianca, in your case regarding your job at Bristol University. Could you just tell us a little bit about what that was like and what they were up to in the whole affair?
Well, I'd been at Bristol University for only a few months when I did a lecture on Islamophobia, in which I discussed my writing on Islamophobia, in particular the role of the Zionist movement, parts of the Zionist movement, in encouraging Islamophobia. And the CST complained about the lecture to the university and said that I was defaming the CST and that what I was saying was quite wrong. The university rejected the complaint because the CST doesn't have any basis to make complaints. You have to be a student to make a complaint. And they couldn't get any students to complain about me, so they approached the Union of Jewish Students and they had them put in a complaint, and they recruited for that the head of the Jewish Society at Bristol to do that. Now, these complaints were eventually rejected, but there was a two-year campaign following this by the CST, by the UJS, and by a whole range of Israel lobby groups, far too many to mention, who consistently argued for me to be sacked. And that culminated in the end in a second investigation of me in February 2021, which eventually resulted in me being sacked in October 21. So there was a long period, almost 3 years, of a concerted attack on me. And the interesting thing about the CST's role here is it goes back a lot further than that 2 to 3 year campaign to my first interactions with the CST when I was an expert witness called for the defence of a Palestinian politician called Sheikh Raed Salah, who was being deported. The Home Office were trying to deport him. And they were trying to deport him based on evidence the CST had provided to the Home Office. And in the course of the proceedings, we got to see this evidence. And amongst other misinformation in there, the CST had provided to the Home Office a translation of a poem by Salah in which the word oppressors had been mistranslated to Jews. And so you could see that there was a process there of misinformation which comes from the files that the CST maintains. It's in part a spy agency. And when I was involved in that case, I revealed what the CST was up to, and they lost the case, and Sheikh Salah was not deported. And so ever since then, this is back in 2011, they've had an animus against me, and they didn't forget that.
Now, Chris, you were obviously involved in your own dispute within the Labour Party regarding the anti-Semitism scandals and so on, the witch hunt, as it's been described by you and some of your allies, if you like. How did the CST play a role in all that?
Well, the CST and the UGS actually had a really pernicious influence, I think, on the Labour Party and led the witch hunt. I mean, I was smeared on a relatively regular basis, both by the CST, a so-called charity, and the Union of Jewish Students as well. And there was an organised campaign to no platform me at universities. Various university bodies, as a result of lobbying by the UGS, and no doubt having reference as well to the CST, were then actually joining in the smear. So there was a kind of real momentum built up behind the attacks that were being levelled against me by the CST and the UGS. And that was essentially because I was speaking up for Palestinian rights and ironically defending anti-Zionist left-wing Jewish comrades who had been suspended from the Labour Party.
Now, David, obviously Michael Gove's relationship with the CST as well is indicative of the wider embrace of pro-Israel organisations by politicians. Perhaps you could go into that, because Michael Gove isn't the only politician that's linked to the CST and their activities.
Well, one of the things that I discovered in doing this research back in 2011 on the CST was their secret list of advisers, which they don't publicise. I was able to find this online. It had been put online inadvertently, and I was able to find this. And amongst the advisers was Michael Gove, but many other politicians on there as well, and indeed many former and current senior police officers on there too. And we were able to point out then that when Michael Gove gave millions of pounds to the CST, that he had a conflict of interest, which should have meant that he had excluded himself from the decision-making process. The Home Office didn't seem to mind about that. But Gove is a very interesting character. He is, of course, I suppose, one of the best-known neoconservatives in this country. He is ferociously pro-Israel. That's one of the people at the heart of government who have been very key in promoting the interests of lobby groups like the CST. There are others too. I mean, they, as it was mentioned in the film, Priti Patel, was had to resign over secret meetings with the Israelis, including meetings in the occupied Golan Heights, where she was talking about the need to send UK aid money, not to the Palestinians, but to the IDF. For their activities in the Golan Heights. Truly extraordinary thing to say. So, yeah, of course, there are many politicians who have the ear of the Israel lobby and who will do their bidding.
And I think what's also interesting is a lot of these politicians, Michael Gove, Priti Patel, they've also been accused of Islamophobia. Michael Gove has actually written some texts regarding his views on Islam, which are considered Islamophobic, to say the least. And they also coincidentally are pro-Israel in the same right. But before we go on to that, let me ask you about this group's link to Bristol University, because I believe you have something to say on that as well.
Well, I mean, the CST complained in March 2019, but it's since come to light that the Gail and Gerald Ronson Family Foundation, which is run by the head of the CST, Gerald Ronson, gave money to the University of Bristol in 2011, 2017, 2018. And as a result, the foundation became part of the Vice-Chancellor's Circle, which is a kind of elite, exclusive club for people to engage with the Vice-Chancellor. Now, we have no evidence that there was any direct relationship between this funding and the pressure to sack me, but it certainly is the case that that there were many people who give funding to the university who called for me to be sacked. I'm aware of this from the internal evidence that there isn't on the matter. So it's an issue, I think, that which could be looked at, but which has not been previously discussed by anyone or noticed, indeed, by anyone.
Now, Chris, David Miller is an academic, one of many that's been targeted by groups like the CST. You're of a politician background, political background. You as well have claimed that the CST, among others, have gone after you. Another politician that has been gone after in a very similar way is Jeremy Corbyn, very well known internationally, the former leader of the Labour Party. Has the CST played any role against him? And if so, could you just elaborate on what they've been up to?
Yes, they have. And I think Jeremy's response and the leadership in general's response, leadership of the Labour Party's response to these accusations actually fed them and made matters worse, because Jeremy continued to backtrack and to apologise for nothing, frankly. I had nothing to apologise about. Jeremy's record on fighting bigotry and racism is second to none. But the problem was that the default position was that whenever there was an accusation of anti-Semitism, the Labour Party backed down, capitulated, And the unit that was charged, the so-called governance and legal unit, with, as it were, administering the disciplinary process in the Labour Party, they had a special unit dealing with anti-Semitism. And the go-to source for information about anti-Semitism was the CST, in particular, Dave Rich, who is the head of policy at the CST. And they obviously conflate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. The Labour Party adopted the IHRA working definition, and all these things coming together resulted in a situation where people were being systematically thrown under the bus. Jeremy Corbyn's strongest supporters, basically, you know, left-wing, anti-racist, pro-Palestinian socialists, were being thrown under the bus on a systematic basis. And the real problem was that people, as I say, charged with dealing with disciplinary matters inside the Labour Party, were looking to a body which has clearly made that conflation. And even the General Secretary, they were besotted by the CST. And little wonder, therefore, we ended up in a situation where ultimately, you know, the Labour Party and that whole move, that whole so-called Corbyn project, that drive towards a transformational socialist programme in the country, was consumed by this. And that, in no small measure, a lot of people have said Labour lost the election in 2019 because of Brexit. That was obviously a factor. But another one that hasn't got, I think, the attention that it deserves is this capitulation to false anti-Semitism slurs. What the leadership should have done, what the party should have done, is to stand up to them and talk about Jeremy's record, talk about the Labour Party record, talk about the people that were being targeted, particularly, as I say, left-wing Jews. I mean, some of the people that were targeted were the children of Holocaust survivors, the children of Auschwitz, people, their parents had survived Auschwitz. It was an absolute scandal, a disgrace. And it destroyed Jeremy Corbyn, it destroyed the Corbyn project, and I believe led directly to the election of a right-wing government of Boris Johnson.
And Chris, I want to ask you about this point as well. It was mentioned in part in Bianca's report earlier in the show. The CST claim that they're about fighting anti-Semitism wherever it is, raising alarm bells. But right now in the Labour Party, it's actually left-wing socialist Jewish members which are being kicked out, booted out, accused of being anti-Semitic, if I'm not mistaken. Perhaps you could elaborate that point.
Yes,
is that true?
I mean, that gives a lie to the assertion by the CST that they're concerned about anti-Semitism. The reality is they're concerned about people exposing, calling out Zionism. Because what we're now seeing is, as you say, left-wing Jewish members of the Labour Party are being thrown out on a systematic basis. And indeed, an organisation called the Jewish Voice for Labour has done some number crunching. And they have worked out that if you're a member of the JVL, I think you're 4 times more likely to be expelled or suspended from the Labour Party. If you're a committee member of the Jewish Voice for Labour, I think they worked out there's something like 150 or 200 times more likely to be disciplined, suspended and expelled from the Labour Party. It's an absolute disgrace. It's a travesty, frankly, a travesty of justice. And, you know, it's... I think that the way in which the party, the leadership of the party, capitulated to these false slurs has opened the floodgates. It's led directly to people like esteemed academics, like Professor David Miller here, being targeted, and others are being targeted as well. And that's why I think, you know, there could be no compromise, in my opinion, and this is what I was arguing for inside the Labour Party at the time, and pleading with Jeremy and socialist members of the Parliamentary Labour Party to draw a line in the sand and to fight back and speak up for Jeremy's reputation, for the party's reputation, for their own reputation, because they were also being demonised by these despicable slurs which are being levelled against people who spent their life fighting racism.
And David, you're of course one of those individuals who did draw a line in the sand. You continued to talk about Israel and crimes against the Palestinians, the issues with Zionism and the Israel lobby and its activities in the UK and elsewhere. And of course, you've been persecuted for that, as you've put it in your own words in the past. But surely you've mentioned this to the university at the time when they were investigating and so on. And there are many other groups which have mentioned and complained about this type of issue, issues with groups like the CST and so on. What was the university's response? Because surely they were being told, look, don't trust what groups like the CST are telling you about about you, about others. What do they know what's going on?
I think there's a sort of naivety in the universities in general in relation to these kinds of issues. I mean, there have been many issues, some of which are not all in the public domain, but Warwick University, Glasgow University, Birmingham, there's been a number of other universities who've had similar sorts of issues come up. We've heard recently about the case of Sheffield Hallam University. I think that the problem is that that universities aren't really familiar with the politics of this. They've been browbeaten into adopting the IHRA definition by the government and by the lobby. And as a result, people who don't have a good grounding in Palestinian human rights campaigning, when they look at the IHRA, they don't really understand how they're supposed to interpret it, and they interpret it in a way which results in perfectly legal, lawful, not anti-Semitic speech being effectively criminalised. And so there's a kind of naivety there. And when you point this out to people, well, they look at you a little bit strangely. They don't understand that this is actually a lobby campaign, which is, as is well known, really, directed from Israel. I mean, the CST was involved very, very early on with the Israeli government in the process which led to the IHRA. The IHRA didn't come from nowhere. It came from Israel lobby groups putting onto the agenda and having it agreed. And so what you have is a hostile foreign power, the Israeli government, trying to intervene in politics, first in the Labour Party and now in the universities, and indeed in many other places as well. And the weapon of choice, as we said in the report, is the IHRA definition. So the problem is that the universities don't really get that. And until and unless we are able to reverse the IHRA adoption in universities, we will see many more people who are disciplined or thrown from their jobs or denied appointments, etc. And that's the difficulty with this whole process, is that the universities roll over, not necessarily because of an ideological commitment to Zionism, but because they don't really know what they're doing.
And, it's interesting that you say that, because a hostile foreign government intervening in British politics, in British education system and so on via these groups. Imagine if, let's say, the Russians were doing that, for example. It'd be a massive nationwide story, international headlines spinning around. But because it's Israel, it's a colonialist ally, if you like, it seems to be totally ignored. In fact, there could even be some cooperation, in fact, from Westminster, as you mentioned. But very briefly, before the show ends, perhaps you could just tell us what you think could or should be done to try and combat against this smear machinery that's going
on. Well, I mean, the unions, the UCU, the University College Union, could do much more than it has done. In some places, it's been very good. In the case of Sheffield Hallam recently, it's been very good. And that's one thing. But the other thing is, of course, that many of these organisations, including the Community Security Trust, are charities, and they are supposed to exist for public benefit. And it's clear that in some of their activities, the activities we've been outlining, they're not acting for public benefit. They're acting in the interests of, a hostile foreign power. And it's about time that the Charity Commission started to take note of this. There are many, many pro-Israel groups in this country, hundreds of them, which are charities, and many of them are effectively violating their own charitable charters. And that's something which, in the fullness of time, I hope to see pushback on, and that the Charity Commission is forced into not allowing activities which are, in effect, collaborating with breaches of international law.
Sure. Well, gentlemen, unfortunately, we are out of time for this edition of the programme, but I'm sure we'll have you back very, very soon, Chris. And David, we'll see you next time for sure. And hopefully we'll see you at home back joining us on the next edition of Palestine Declassified. Until next time, it's bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com irib.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The U.S. is selling Saudi Arabia $650 million worth of missiles and providing $500 million worth of maintenance for U.S.-made aircraft, training and other support for its military operations. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kerry Peterson-Smith Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Saudi Arabia Arms Sales is one of Biden's many militaristic actions in first year. Stay tuned for more. Given the brutish approach of his predecessor, many expected President Joe Biden to shift away from the worst practices in U.S. foreign policy and at the border in the previous 40 years. Indeed, in the first weeks of his presidency, the Biden administration signaled changes. In Secretary of State Antony Blinken's first press briefing, the State Department announced that it was reviewing weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which have led the catastrophic war in Yemen with essential U.S. partnership. A week later, Biden declared in his first foreign policy address as president that we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Regarding his practices at the border, Biden administration officials promised a shift away from Trump's practices of separating families and caging children, calling them a moral failing. He said that the new White House would deal with immigration comprehensively, fairly, and humanely. As 2021 comes to a close, however, we are seeing the latter part of the trajectory that settles into familiar, disastrous militarism. The United States is selling Saudi Arabia $650 million worth of missiles and providing $500 million worth of maintenance for U.S.-made aircraft, training, and other support for its military operations. These arrangements come as Saudi Arabia is escalating its devastating bombing in Yemen. In November, Saudi forces carried out the largest number of airstrikes since Trump's last year in office. These bookends Biden's early announcement of an end to U.S. support for the war in Yemen and his subsequent robust material support of that war captured the set of practices that the Biden White House is settling into, not only in Yemen, but also in the realm of war and imperialism more broadly. Consider the White House's approval of a $23 billion weapons sales to the UAE, which provides the Emirates with attack drones and F-35 fighter jets. The arrangement was negotiated under the Trump administration as the prize for the UAE's role in leading the normalization of diplomatic relations between the Zionist regime and itself, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, despite the Zionist regime's deepening violence against Palestinians. The Biden administration embraced the normalization agreements along with Trump's other actions meant to consolidate U.S. support and extend legitimacy to the Zionist regime in a time when Palestinian protest presents a steady challenge to the Israeli apartheid and global Palestine solidarity campaigns have gained more traction than ever. Trump fulfilled long-standing wishes of the Israeli regime right wing, including moving the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds from Tel Aviv, declaring the legality of the Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian West Bank, which are considered unambiguously illegal according to international law, and endorsing the Zionist regime occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights. Yet, when it comes to concrete action, Biden has accepted and continued along his predecessor's path. This continuity is also painfully evident regarding Biden's actions toward migrants, many of whom have been displaced due to U.S. imperialist policies. For example, in the face of severe social, political, and economic crises in Central America, which are driven by decades of Washington-directed economic policies and brutal repression carried out by U.S. armed regimes in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, Kamala Harris in Guatemala City, on her first overseas tour as vice president, presented the U.S. foreign policy in cruelty do not come. Once they approach or enter the country, migrants face a complex of forces that remains in place to detain, incarcerate, and deport migrants and prevent their entry to the United States. Biden has maintained the use of Title 42, a statute that allows the federal government special powers in public health emergencies to deny migrants, including asylum seekers, access at the U.S.-Mexico border in violation of international law. Biden is thus continuing Trump's use of the measure, which was invoked when the COVID-19 pandemic began. Public health professionals and scholars have argued that the measure cannot be justified in the name of public health and have called upon the administration to end it. Biden has also reopened some of the most notorious detention sites highlighted in the Trump era, including Florida's Homestead Shelter for Unaccompanied Children. The numbers of people in detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, have swelled to 22,000 under Biden, marking a 56% increase since the day the new president took office. Biden's most dramatic and revealing act at the border this year was his handling of the arrival of thousands of primarily Haitian asylum seekers at Del Rio, Texas, in September. From Border Patrol agents on horseback whipping the black migrants to their confinement in squalid conditions on riverbanks and under a bridge, the U.S. government and its police forces engaged in racist violence, treating the Haitians as a criminal threat to its contained rather than vulnerable people with the right to seek refuge and asylum. Biden deported the groups of thousands to Haiti in an operation that revealed the logistical capacity at his disposal, which could, of course, instead be used to welcome people and support their survival. Finally, the Biden administration has resumed Trump's infamous Remain in Mexico policy, which forces people seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border to apply in Mexico and wait there while their applications are processed. The policy goes against the U.S. law, which guarantees people the right to apply for asylum inside the U.S., regardless of how they entered. Biden initially opposed the program, suspending it in February. In the face of rulings by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, however, the White House negotiated a new version of the policy with the Mexican government and has begun to administer it, the program which made tens of thousands of asylum seekers vulnerable to kidnapping, assault, and other hazards in Mexico under Trump, is now Biden's. At the moment, Afghanistan faces mass hunger and an economic catastrophe as billions of dollars belonging to the Afghan Central Bank sit in the United States, frozen by order of Biden administration. Yet amid these blatant continuations of state violence, grassroots pressure has clearly made an impact. Biden's rhetorical vows to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen, for example, MTS Devor were responses, in significant part, to a years-long, consistent and vocal challenge of U.S. support for the war.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Who's really responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? The recent drowning of at least 27 migrants has led to renewed calls for a new approach to the ongoing crisis caused by those trying to start a new life in the United Kingdom. While British government officials claim it is on track to fix the broken asylum system, legislation has been criticised for making it harder for those arriving by boat to claim asylum in Britain. Those who speak for refugees even say the new proposals are actually cruel.
There's a pattern to the problem. A large proportion of these migrants come from Iraq, Syria and Afghanistan, all countries torn apart by conflict supported or even started by Anglo-American military escapades. Furthermore, while the UN Refugee Agency says deaths can be avoided with coordinated action, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have fallen out after the French president objected to Mr. Johnson's accusations that France has not done enough to stop migrants crossing the Channel. The impact of these political and military conflicts has turned out to be lethal. War and conflict disrupt countries and entire regions, forcing migrants to flee. In their desperate efforts to start a new life, some pay traffickers large sums to assist them in their efforts to cross the Channel to England. This leads to illegal immigration, increasing tensions between France and the United Kingdom, and deaths in the sea, while France and Britain blame each other for the migration issue and the human toll of those who drown.
To what extent is the UK responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? And who should be creating a new place for people to live after escaping from war-torn conflicts in which the United Kingdom plays a part? Simple questions with important answers. And we begin our inquiry with a straightforward and direct question. What does the public think of the deaths of 27 migrants who drowned while trying to cross the Channel? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
A boat which is about the size as that one that goes up and down the river here, the small one. 27 people were on it and it capsized and they drowned this was last week. Yeah, and they just drowned and their bodies were washed up on the shore. Yeah.
It's so sad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, things like that should not be happening in the future, of course.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I just wish that there were actually legal safe routes for people to get to Britain in order to claim refugee status.
The way that we... So we talk about, you know, helping people and things like foreign aid, but when there's real issues like people trying to escape persecution, I think it's shameful that the government, you know, practically ignores or tries to deflect the problem.
I mean, it's just a shame, really, isn't it? I mean, it's upsetting when anyone dies, let alone migrants. I mean, there's the whole... I'm sure like, an overwhelming majority are just trying to escape what can be just explained nothing short of an absolute travesty.
Sad and disappointed.
I don't think that's very nice to hear at all.
They have family, they have mother, father, sons, daughter, and I think we or the government need to pay the attention in that case.
I think it's a terrible tragedy. I don't think anyone deserves to die when trying to gain freedom and have the rights that we should all be given as human beings upon this earth.
Well, obviously, wasted life is always a tragedy, but it would not happen if people didn't get on broken lilos and try to cross the busiest waterway in the world in treacherous weather.
Horrific, and why don't we have a secure way whereby these people fleeing from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria are able to come to this country? Where I think we've opened the doors to, is it 3 million from Hong Kong? Why can't we find a humane, civilised way of helping these people?
It's very sad. It's sad that they have to move, like, come over here and try and find, like, obviously living over here. Like, it's sad that they have to do that, like, rather risk their life than just trying to find a better life where they actually are. I don't know, it's quite sad.
French government is responsible first because that's their border. And then the British government should take care of their English waters or English Channel to control the border. I think nobody should risk their life for better life.
It's terrible. It shouldn't have never happened in the first place. I mean, they should just have safe passage to prevent this to start with.
First, I suppose, used the word tragic, and it is a tragedy.
Obviously, I think everybody can be completely sympathetic to the situation. And, yeah, of course, I think everybody was greatly saddened by the situation, considering there were children involved as well, which makes it even worse.
Many are refugees from conflicts fought by Britain, including in Afghanistan, Iraq and other Middle Eastern countries. In the public's view, what responsibility does the UK have for these deaths?
I think we have a responsibility to provide safe passage for people to come here to attempt to claim refugee status. If we feel that we have the right to go and intervene in different ways around the world, then we have the responsibility to kind of follow up the results of that, I think.
Oh, we have massive responsibility. You know, it's anything that, you know, is initiated or guns that we sell to different parties in these conflicts is entirely, you know, the British government's responsibility to do something about it.
There's a very, very valid argument to make that to a certain extent, intervention in certain countries has worsened political situations. I mean, the arguable thing, you know, you can look at situations like maybe Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan is a very good one, I think.
I think we're responsible if we're involved in the conflict, but we're also responsible as a better-off country to help people who are not safe.
It's hard to pinpoint the exact responsibility if the conflict that they're running from is caused by the UK or at least contributed to by the UK. There's definitely some responsibility there, in my opinion anyway.
Well, this should be something that maybe the governments of the world should look at, and those of us who have more to give should be able to give and allow safe haven for these people.
I think we do have some responsibility for taking our fair share of refugees from conflicts that we've had a part in.
They're mainly refugees from countries which have internal problems, and that's why there was an influence from the British. And there are a number of countries that they could have stopped in along the way if they truly wanted somewhere that was just safer than where they came from.
These crossings are a consequence of us so-called global Britain meddling around in the Middle East, so we have a lot of responsibility.
I don't really know who to blame, but I'm pretty sure both sides should be responsible, like both France and the Britain part. Because is there a kind of shared channel, I guess, so.
There's some implicit responsibility because, you know, we've armed these countries, we've been involved militarily, and we haven't supported some of the kind of the transportation of the immigrants in the first place that were suffering in these countries.
That's a very loaded question. I think obviously they've travelled many miles to get to the UK. Clearly, I think there's a lot of discussion about being housed in the first port of call of whichever country they go to. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that situation, but I guess if they do get to the UK, they're entitled to a hearing. They're entitled to the civil liberties, and obviously they're entitled to actually put their case forward. And that's the problem. I don't think they do get that. And perhaps the UK needs to have a rethink on that point.
Yes, some days ago, also, I heard about the problem in Afghanistan. I think that's something that is impossible to think in the 21st century.
French police have been seen to watch on as many refugees board boats to cross the channel. What do people here in Britain think of the French allowing migrants to make these hazardous crossings?
The French police have watched on. They've been filmed watching on while the traffickers send the boats across. What do you think about that?
It's difficult because if they stop them, then they stop them being able to try and find somewhere safer. But at the same time, it's not a safe journey either. But that's a tough one.
From a legal perspective, it very well could be justified. From my opinion, that doesn't come across as right.
Yeah, I wish that there was closer and better tempered and more even collaboration between Britain and France and between Britain and the rest of the EU over this, to be fair. It's obviously not ideal that people are being allowed to launch themselves into small, unsafe boats into the channel. We've seen the result of that this year, so I wish that wasn't happening.
If we start the war, obviously we should be taking responsibility for it. So, I mean, yeah.
The entire international community needs to take some responsibility and work together, like I say, to try and find a solution.
If you're seeing somebody getting on a boat that you know is probably not going to make it, I mean, in my opinion, I would be saying, don't make that crossing.
I think it's a responsibility of the French government.
Didn't see them to know if that's true or not. If it is, then they should be held accountable, but I haven't seen any evidence either way on that.
A very complex issue, I think. It's wrong of them to not intervene, although there's always circumstances around everything. But I think there's always a duty of care to people, no matter who or where they come from.
I can't understand how we haven't taken back control from the French police.
I think that's part of the reason why they want to come over here, because they're just not getting looked after very well, clearly, are they? If they're getting allowed to get on the boats, causing tragedies and they're allowing it to happen. We're trying to stop it and they're allowing it to happen and allowing them to come while we're trying to stop.
I think British government, to be honest, because if you get involved in someone else's business, then there is always the consequences. So you have to face the consequences.
Basically, it's wherever they seek in, whichever country they look at to find asylum, that's where they should be housed in the first place.
I think what I probably would like to say, you wouldn't want to repeat, but I think that's absolutely disgusting. Clearly, if it's on the shores of the UK, we would expect the police to do their duty, and I think the same thing should apply to the French police.
The statistics underline the size of the issue and how little Britain is really doing to fix it. The Home Office plans to accept 5,000 people in the first year of the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, and up to 20,000 more afterwards. However, by late November 2021 alone, it is estimated that during this year, over 26,000 people, many from Afghanistan, had already arrived in small boats after crossing the channel illegally. Yet the Afghan conflict, in which the UK played a central role, generated 2.5 million refugees, of whom 2.2 million live in Iran and Pakistan, showing how small the UK's contribution is to fixing the problem it helped cause. Who should be held responsible for finding new homes for refugees escaping conflicts fought by Britain?
I think
think a lot of responsibility therefore comes onto the government to make sure that we can give safe passage to these refugees and we can allow them in and look after them as the conflict is our fault.
I believe they should have handled the issue like in a more accurate, in a more precise manner.
Just because that's the country they went in first doesn't mean that country has equal responsibility for them being a refugee in the first place.
We're partly responsible, and countries should work together. Unfortunately, we seem to be global Britain going it alone, but we should work, like with the health crisis on COVID, countries should work together to solve these problems, be it climate change, refugees. It's a shame that we don't have anyone with any diplomatic skills from Lord Frost, Rab, Priti Patel, Boris, to make sure we are responsible global citizens.
It should be a shared effort between more governments. I'd say Britain, France, and whoever participated in that, in those wars. That would seem fair to me.
Allow them to make the crossing. Letting people make something that's unsafe where they could possibly lose their lives is almost like a criminal act. They're complicit in the deaths, in a way, by letting that happen. Yeah.
Well, again, I think it's down to probably every country to do their part. And we hear all the figures on the media. You never know whether you're hearing the right figures or not. Fairly obviously, I think other countries in Europe probably have taken more than the UK, and possibly the UK need to rethink their policy in that respect.
Who's actually responsible for rehousing people who've been victims of conflict that Britain itself has led or been involved in?
I think if people have refugee status in Britain, then Britain is responsible for rehousing them. We shouldn't forget that Britain has, I think, around about 1% of the world's refugees here. We have a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's refugees. And if we want to see ourselves as global Britain, as a country that has a role on the global stage, then we need to step up and take responsibility for some of this.
I would not like to comment on that, yeah, but these things should not be happening. I mean, if they are watching it, they should have stopped it, of course.
I don't want to just pile blame onto my own government. It's obviously the responsibility of all governments to try and find a solution for these people.
But it is our responsibility as humans, as common man, to account for one another. So not just the government, but we all, as a collective, need to step up and do something about it.
My opinion is, rather than trying to figure out exactly who is responsible, is that if you feel you can do something, and as a country, if we feel we can do something, then we just should.
What is the public's advice to the British government about refugees who risk death in the process of trying to cross the Channel?
I think these practices should be stopped. I mean, force measures should be taken to stop it, because if the people are trying to cross the Channel, they can lose their lives. So, yeah, of course.
My advice to government would be to work with people, with our friends and colleagues in the EU, to step up and to act more humanely, to give people safe passage routes.
If the government wants to, you know, be re-elected, they need to take action and do something about it.
There are plenty of people in the country who would want to help. It's just reaching out and maybe putting together a system where people who can help and can provide housing, or even if it's just temporary. You know, there's a lot of people with spare bedrooms.
Everybody knows it's an issue, and it's been an issue for quite some time. My advice would be stop ignoring it. Do something.
Let's try and find a way where they don't have to risk death, and we can help them if it is that we're responsible.
Oh, I think, Britain can help people who are homeless to find homes and so on.
I would say it's a very complex situation, but human life has to be saved amongst anything else. But I think rather than spending so much time trying to dissuade people from crossing, they should look at the reason why the people are going in the first place.
Work with other countries in a diplomatic manner to find a solution.
Should be able to give them set boats and, you know, better like accommodation to come over on, rather than just a dinghy that's probably going to sink halfway across. Like, we've got the boats, we've got like all the lifeguards and everything. We could be helping save more than anything, do you know what I mean? We have lifeguards that swim the channels on a night time to make sure everything's all good, so we could be making things a lot safer, and communication with the other governments as well is even better. Like,
it doesn't matter what their, like, what country they came from, but their life matters, so they should be taken care of. They should have been taken care of.
Not all the immigrants are genuine immigrants. Most of them, they are economic immigrants.
So finding ways to support them in their own country so they don't have to cross the borders. First place. If they have come over risking their life, then find the ways to settle them.
Create a safe passage. That's all we need is a safe passage. They shouldn't be risking their lives in the first place. Otherwise, they are complicit in what's happening.
Again, I think we need to put something into place, a more meaningful policy in place to give these people a chance to have their story heard, to have their situation checked.
The 27 migrants who drowned in the English Channel as they tried unsuccessfully to reach British shores made the headlines. These fatalities also provoked a bitter war of words between British and French politicians after UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson